This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
Now it's time to ask an astronomer. The first question comes from Marion Fraser. She's received an interesting email about Mars. The email that she's received claims that Mars will be so close to the Earth in August that it will look the same size as the Moon, and she's wondering if that's true.
Well, the quick answer is no, it's not true. But just the backstory to this, I think this is not quite a spam email, but it's getting there, which I think started circulating in around about 2003. And I'll explain why in a minute. But I noticed recently I've received, well, several emails, not just Marion's had, there's other people sent forwarded it on to me actually in the last month or so. So it's obviously started doing the rounds again. And yeah, of course, you know, if Mars got to be the size of the full moon in the sky, I think we'd all think that was quite spectacular. We'd be able to see, you know, all different sorts of features on the surface of Mars very easily with the naked eye. And it's not going to get that big. But there is some, you know, there's some truth. As usual, there's a kernel of truth in these things. And in this case, it's the fact that that Mars occasionally comes closer than it does at other times to the Earth and therefore appears larger. So if you think about it, imagine the solar system, you think about the Sun sort of at the centre and the Earth orbiting around, and then out beyond that, Mars orbiting around. Then you can imagine at times Mars is closer to the Earth than at other times. And of course, as the Earth sort of overtakes Mars on the inside, that's really the point at which they get the closest together, and that would be the point at which Mars would appear the largest. Now, that turns out, just because of the relative distances from the Sun, it turns out that that occurs about every 2 years and 2 months. So about every 2 years and 2 months, Earth passes on the inside of Mars, and so Mars looks at its biggest. Now, the distances from the Earth to the Sun is about 1.5 times 10 to the 8 kilometres, so that's 150 million kilometres, the distance from the Earth to the Sun. And the distance from Mars to the Sun is 230 million kilometres. So in fact, if you just subtract the two, you'd expect to get the closest separation being 80 million kilometres. Yeah. Now what happens is you get some variation around that because actually the orbits aren't circular. They're elliptical. Mars's orbit's actually rather more elliptical than the Earth's. So you can imagine just depending on where they are in that elliptical orbit, you'll get closer approaches. And also they're inclined at an angle. And again, it would depend just where you were in that orbit as to whether you were closer. There's even some sort of minor effects due to the effects of the Moon on the Earth and so on that you have to factor in. Well, basically, as I say, this sort of thing arose because in 2003, the distance of the closest approach was about 56 million kilometres. So I remember I just said the sort of average value would be 80 million. So it did get as close as 56 million. So it would have appeared, you know, proportionally that much larger. 2005, it was 69 million. 2007, 88 million. 2010, 99 million. So you can see it's sort of rising a bit. Again, the next time it gets, you know, almost as close as it did in 2003 is actually not till 2018, when in fact it's sort of 58 million kilometres away. So it's just that sort of variation. So yeah,
much smaller than the Moon.
Much smaller than the Moon. Yeah.
Second inquiry comes from Sarah. She is looking for an online lunar calendar of the Southern Hemisphere, but so far she's been unable to find one, and is hoping that you can point her to a suitable website.
Yeah, I mean, I do this sort of thing occasionally, just sort of looking, in fact, just to give you a preview of something we're doing at Jodrell, we're doing a sort of exciting event around the time of the 40th anniversary of the moon landings in July. You know, obviously the Apollo 11 moon landing was in July of 1969, so we're going to run an event that we'll tell you all about on the Jodcast later in the summer. But for that reason, I was interested in where the moon was. So there's various online resources that would do that for you, but the one I would commonly go to first is actually something provided by the United States Naval Observatory, the USNO. So you could just do a Google for Naval Observatory and position of Moon, but we'll put the link for this on our website. The US Naval Observatory is actually, turns out, it provides quite a lot of handy astronomical data and web calculators on their web pages. It's actually the official source of time for the USA. So they have the atomic clocks and things that do the time. So it's sort of grown out of that whole history of navigation being linked to astronomy, which is why it would have been naval observatory originally. But for example, they do things like astronomical calculators like rise and set times for both the sun and the moon, phases of the moon and so on. So yeah, they've got a nice thing there that just you can put in what US city or town you're in, or for certainly for this case, when we're talking about Southern Hemisphere, there's locations worldwide as well, in which case you would put in your longitude and latitude, and it'll come back and it'll give you the sort of lots of different bits of information on what's happening with the moon, what's happening with the sun, and so on and so forth through the year. So we'll stick a link to that on the website.
Okay. The last question is a theory question from Paul Saxton. He says, I've heard and read with fascination a lot about string theory in the last few years. Do the Jodrell team think that they'll be able to contribute at some point to confirming some of the implications of this mind-blowing theory?
Yeah, well, I mean, perhaps we should just say very briefly what string theory is. I mean, string theory is a theory of particle physics, basically. So it's a theoretical physics concept that relates to how we understand the very tiniest constituents of matter. So things like electrons, things like quarks that make up the particles like protons and neutrons that are in the nucleus of an atom. And traditionally those things would have been thought of as sort of point-like particles. And what string theory did was to take a different approach to understanding their behavior, was to model them as effectively as one-dimensional objects, lines effectively, vibrating strings. And then what happens is that the observed properties of the particle then depend in some sense on the properties of the vibration, so its frequency and so on and so forth. And it's been one of the major theories of modern particle physics. But I guess the problem with it is how do you test it? You know, how can you tell whether it's really true or not? And I think that it's a theory that it's really it's high energy particle physics. So in some sense, you'd want to recreate the highest energies to try and look for observable consequences of this theory. And so one way in which that might be done is in major particle physics colliders, like the colliders at CERN and elsewhere, and the theories would predict certain properties of the collisions and so on. Now, in fact, here at Jodrell, we don't have any particular role in those experiments, but what we do have a role in, as listeners will probably be aware, is in studying the cosmic microwave background radiation. So this is the relic radiation of the Big Bang. And of course, the point here is that conditions a fraction of a second after the Big Bang are the sorts of conditions in which the effects of this sort of string theory might actually produce some observable consequence. Now, in particular, what's obviously happened this week is that we've launched the Planck spacecraft, and the Planck spacecraft is designed to basically provide the best ever map of the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background in this fading glow of the Big Bang. So this was this light that set off, about 380,000 years after the Big Bang, and has been stretched out into the microwave part of the spectrum now. But embedded within it, sort of imprinted in it, is this the sort of fossils, the relic of the tiny changes in physical conditions that were true around 380,000 years after the Big Bang. But in fact, those things were probably imprinted, within them, there's some sort of signature of, perhaps, this idea of something called inflation in cosmology, which was that a tiny fraction of a second, 10 to the minus 34 seconds after the Big Bang. So if you think about that, what that means, 10 to the minus 2 is 0.01. So 10 to the minus 34 is actually 0.33 zeros and a 1. So it's a tiny fraction of a second after the Big Bang. We think that maybe the universe expanded at basically super light speed, maybe becoming something like 10 to the 30 times larger, so that's a 1 followed by 30 zeros, than it was before inflation. And so in the cosmic microwave background, it's possible that there's signatures in those fluctuations that would give us a clue as to whether string theory was really true or not. And that's one of the more we're not really sure, because we don't know at what energy scale these theories really apply. But it's possible that it would left behind a signature that Planck will be able to detect. So I guess we might hear more about that from the group here in maybe in the next couple of years.
Is it possible that a detection of a gravitational wave background could probe back to,
yeah,
to even earlier than the cosmic microwave background?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the sort of thing that, I mean, there's lots of different things. There's sorts of basically gravitational waves are these sort of ripples that you know, if they were passing through us now, they'd sort of be stretching and squashing us all the time. And again, if you can look for those, the signature of those gravitational waves having affected the plasma that became transparent, that the CMB arises in, then you can actually, again, you can test those theories of what happened before the cosmic microwave background. Because, of course, the usual thing to talk about is that in a sense, the cosmic microwave background is the oldest light that we'll see, because when when the universe was younger than 380,000 years, it was so dense that light was forever scattering off free electrons. So light scatters off electrons in the plasma of the early universe, and so it's like walking around in a fog. You can't see very far because the light's scattering off the water droplets. But as the universe expanded, that fog thinned. In this case, what happened actually is the electrons then recombine with the protons and make the first hydrogen atoms, for example. You've massively reduced the number of free electrons, you reduce the amount of scattering of light, and that light becomes free to travel. Effectively, the fog clears, the universe becomes transparent. That light was originally a sort of dullish orange red. temperature of the universe was about 3,000 degrees, you know, something like Betelgeuse, that sort of colour, the red giant star. And that light's been expanded out now by maybe a factor of 1,000, and so it's now, the wavelength's increased by a factor of 1,000, it's now in the invisible microwave spectrum. But yeah, studying the details of what the fluctuations in the intensity, the temperature of that cosmic microwave background is actually telling us something about the physics that was happening up to that point.
Well, thanks to the listeners for those questions, and thanks Tim for answering them.
That's no problem. Speak to you again next month.